Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Who wants to start with Genesis 1, and let's do the first creation account? I'd like to do it in summary, but certainly feel free, guys, to draw attention to certain verses. But let's do the first Genesis creation account, and then we'll do the second and see where we're at after that. So describe the first account, and then go ahead and describe the second account in very, very general terms, and then we'll go back and dive into the first. So when you have the first and the second ones, what do you generally see, David?
So we should first talk about what we mean by the first and second, because they don't actually line up in terms of the chapter divisions.
Right.
Chapter divisions are added many, many centuries after these texts were originally produced and even brought together by our redactor. So the first creation account begins with Genesis 1:1 and then runs through chapter 2, to verse 4, and we would distinguish halfway through verse 4, so 2:4a. And this is certainly the scholarly consensus on where the textual parameters should be divided and considered. And the reason for that, if we look at Genesis 1:1, it begins in the King James Bible, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." Very famous passage, of course, that our listeners will be familiar with. Then the story tells about the 6 days of creation, the seventh day rest, and continues into chapter 2. And after identifying the seventh day that God rests upon, we have in verse 4 a summary statement. "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created." That's the end. And there's a compelling reason to identify it as such. There are many compelling reasons. One being the repetition of the key words the key words creation, earth, and heaven that appear in verse 1:1 and in 2:4a, that summary statement at the end. And this is a literary or textual device that scholars often refer to as inclusio. And inclusio take key words from the beginning of the text, repeat them at the end, and it shows that this is a distinct literary unit and should be analyzed from that perspective.
Right. Now, in King James, you have a problem because they've put a comma after created and made it sound like the what starts next, whereas at least the NSV that I have open here actually begins with a new sentence, and so it makes it a little bit clearer to see that there is a 4a and a 4b.
Ah, good. Yes, more recent translations will pick up on this. I like to, in my survey of the Hebrew Bible course that I teach at the University of Utah, I like to use the Jewish Publication Society translation, and I have students get the study Bible version of that, which is edited by Mark Brettler and Adele Berlin. And I, it's a wonderful modern translation. Our listeners, I would obviously extend the same invitation to them to take a look at it. And it's nice because they're going to do precisely what you're saying, Dan. They put a big blank spot in between 4a and 4b, because 4b then is the start of the second creation. And for Latter-day Saints, well, it's wonderful because Joseph Smith himself is sensitive that there should be a textual break there. Because we actually see the same exact, we see this division being emphasized in terms of Joseph Smith's production of the Book of Moses. And Joseph Smith's Book of Moses is going to identify that first story of creation as a spiritual creation. All things are created spiritually before they were created temporally. And then we move into what that revelation from the prophet Joseph will refer to as a physical creation, beginning with Genesis chapter 2, 4b. So I think that's incredibly exciting that Joseph sensed sensitive to the fact that there is a textual, that there's a difference here. And the two accounts are very different, Dan, in terms of not only the theological view, but also the order sequence. So, for example, in the story in Genesis.
Well, and just, okay, do the examples in a second. Now, this is often called the JP seam, right? This break, is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay, so there's this seam between the writer J and the writer P. The Yahwist is the J writer, the P is the priestly writer, and you can give us clues as to why that's there, but that just wanted to insert the JP seam as a thing here. And so go ahead and now, yeah, do the overview of why they're so different.
We'll start then, since you opened the door for that. The reason that the second account is identified with that J source, going back to Wellhausen's model, is that that account is going to consistently use the divine name Jehovah or Yahweh in Hebrew. And that stands in contrast to the creation story in Genesis 1, which uses the Hebrew name word Elohim, meaning God. It's translated as such in the King James Version. But so that's one of the distinctions. But the other...
But it's the priestly writer, though, that uses Elohim as well as the E writer, right?
They both use the same title. It's precise.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why some scholars have opted for a J and E writer.
As the same writer?
Yes.
Oh, always.
It's a minority position, but some have opted out for it.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. Okay, good. All right, so David, now, yeah, do the overview of why is the J, the P version so different from the J version?
So first, Genesis 1 tells the story of creation, and the basic structure of the narrative is God speaks and things come into existence in according to a day-by-day creative process over 6 days, of course. But that creation narrative follows a sequence where the plants are created first, the animals are created second, and then finally, man and woman are created on the same day, sixth day. And then we get through this narrative, we get to what feels certainly like a concluding statement. Again, 4a, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created. And then all of a sudden, the text moves and begins to use the divine name Yahweh, or Jehovah, which is translated as Lord with capital letters in the King James translation. And it's as if creation, everything we read about, it's as if it never occurred. We immediately just start again, right? And this time, not only do we have a different name for God, but the sequence is completely different than what we've just gone through. Now, man will be created first from out of the dust of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Plants will be created. Remember, it was first plants, then animals, then man. So Genesis 2, man created because he's created out of the ground. Then the plants emerge. And then God says, well, he needs a companion. He needs someone to help him with this agricultural assignment that he has to care for the garden. So let's create some sort of helper. The animals are then created. And then, of course, none of them prove effective and able to assist in the labor. And then woman is created. The last creative element is woman. She's created out of the rib, and there's that famous story that our listeners will be familiar with. So we have two totally different views on creation, but we also have different terminology and different perspectives on what on God himself as portrayed in these two narratives. The first view of God is that God is incredibly distant and removed. He's this actor in the universe that is not as nearly as anthropomorphic or human-like as Yahweh in Genesis chapter 2. And that's conveyed in a lot of ways. And what I like to point students to primarily is that famous Hebrew verb that Joseph Smith draws our attention to, by the way, in Genesis 1, translated as create, the Hebrew verb bara. And that throughout the Hebrew Bible, is a divine verb. It is never used with humankind. Only God baras. It's not a type of creation that a human could ever be involved with. And that stands in direct contrast then to when we jump to the second narrative, where it begins in 2:4b, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Different Hebrew verb translated as made. It's the same Hebrew verb that describes human activity. So Abraham will make, same Hebrew verb, an altar. out of stone. It's the same Hebrew verb that's used to describe the savory meat that Jacob will prepare for Isaac. So God is very human-like, including, he goes on, he literally works. He doesn't speak creation in Genesis 2. He works with the soil and takes and causes, and it says literally that he planted a garden in verse 8. And then later on in the narrative, we're going to see the same very human-like deity actually choose to walk through the garden in the cool of the day because he does it too hot,
right?
And that's in Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, where he walks in the cool of the day. So two very different views on creation, two very different views on God.
Yeah, so interesting. So David, that's fun to have, you know, those laid out exactly, because that's how they are. And if you weren't trying to read them, if you weren't trying to think of them as one piece, you would totally get different feels for what creation is and all that stuff. Now, it's so interesting to me that in some ways, I think many of us in Mormonism prefer the it's the P document that uses Elohim and stuff like that, because we like the, when God creates man and woman, they create them together in our own image. And the fact that that P writer uses Elohim, and we all have this vague, you know, high school level sense of what Elohim means as a plural term, we tend to prefer that. But on the other hand, most of the rest of our theology is more like a Yahweh who would walk in the garden at night.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, Dan. And I would actually say that we are not alone in, as Latter-day Saints, in preferring the creation story in Genesis 1 over 2. It appears first, right? And that, and therefore, the redactor, who many assume has a priestly sensitivity, wants us, in a sense, to do just precisely that. Now, when we read these two creation stories, we read the second story through the lens of Genesis chapter 1.
Oh, nice.
So, which is really probably the editor's intent. And going back to your observation of how we prefer it, what one of the interesting things, Dan, is that no doubt many of our listeners have sat in a gospel doctrine lesson where we've talked about the two contradictory commandments, the one in Genesis 1 to go forth, multiply, replenish the earth. Then Genesis chapter 2, where God says, do not partake of the fruit that's going to grant you that knowledge that you can fulfill and live that commandment. And we explain that, therefore, theologically with this wonderful, that I'm not at all critical of, it's a beautiful construct of, this allows for the agency to develop. But for some of us, perhaps as we've sat, and this has been, it hasn't really quite made sense, and we've always wondered, why the contradictions, and why would God act this way? Well, this is where source criticism helps, right? Because these are two totally different views explaining how humankind was not only created, but then developed and became who we are, how we became who we are today. And that's why you have these contradictions that probably have never felt right to many of our listeners.
Awesome.
Two different stories.
Now, Tom, would you quickly riff for a second on the term Elohim, because I know it's, you know, for a lot of us that we have this view that it's simply means plural beings or something like that. Does it always mean that throughout the text?
No, and it's tied to a singular verb. It's first time in the Hebrew Bible. It can mean God. It can mean the mighty council that Yahweh addresses, where in the second account there's a vacillation between singular, the one spokesman, you know, addresses the mighty council and says that, you know, man has become as one of us to know good and evil. It's a wisdom statement. And then there are other uses of it as well, B'nai Elohim in Genesis 6, verse 2, and even as glorified soldiers, you know, in David's army, the term Elohim can be used as Elder Talmage just pointed out, you know, for judges and other divine affairs of state. And so there's a whole range of things that Kyle and Dalich pointed out in their Old Testament commentary when they said it's wrong to try to build a Trinitarian construct out of Elohim. In fact, it cannot be done.
Interesting. That'll be fun for a lot of people. When you say the word council, our Mormon ears just perk right up and all that kind of stuff. Especially when Joseph Smith in Nauvoo had been learning some Hebrew and he starts playing with the head council, the head god of all the council and all that stuff. So we won't go into that, but I do want to stick with the first account versus the second account there. And am I right in remembering, and again, I only have just enough knowledge to be slightly dangerous, but am I remembering that in the first account, the term Adam is really a Hebrew verb that sort of means humankind or all of...
According to Von Rod, that is spot on.
Okay, so there's that versus in the second one, that's when you finally get individual man and woman, Adam, Eve.
Where the image is split, and that leads into marriage and coming back together to restore the image under God in marriage.
But it actually, what we see in Genesis, the story in 2, is it's Ha-Adam, which, and Ha is the definite article in Hebrew, so it's the man. And
right.
Okay. Yeah, it's not Adam in Genesis chapter 2, it's the man. And which is interesting because the woman is called the woman until she consumes the fruit in Genesis 2. Then after she's consumed the fruit, then she gets the name Eve or life giver, because it's through eating the fruit that she gains this ability to have knowledge to procreate.
That's right.
Okay, so the man means still we're still in the collective human being.
Well, it's Adam means collective, a collective human, but in Genesis chapter 2, no, it's simply best translated as the man.
The man, because yeah. of the definite article.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's not a collective, it's a specific, but it's not a proper noun, is what I'm saying, because a proper noun would not need to be defined with, we wouldn't say the Dan. Or
well, sure you would, because I'm so unique, but okay.
Without question. Without question, my friend. But that's... Yeah, so that's kind of where we're going with that.
Okay, so you're saying even in Genesis 1, when there's the term Adam, or is there the term Adam there at all? When do we get the guy that Mormons think is Michael? Is it even in the Ha-Adam part?
No, well, it's not Adam, their proper noun. It's just the man, and will appear as such in more recent translations of the Bible. In other words, you're asking the question, when does Adam become proper noun as opposed to noun? And let's see, I believe it's in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1 that we first start to see that, but I'd have to go to and look at the Hebrew.
Now, the reason for me going into this, and I think I've now realized that I'm wrong, somehow or other, I thought that if someone who knew the Hebrew and saw that this was the term that simply meant the man, or that it was this broader thing, it was easier for us to recognize that even the writer themselves was signaling, I'm dealing here in mythic sort of broad, you know, archetypal, you know, all humankinds are basically going through these same trials as these guys.
Could we make a comment here, if anyone does, on Genesis 4, verse 1, where it says, she conceived and bore a king, saying, I've gotten a man with the help of the Lord. That seems like a weak translation of Kinete et Yahweh. Mm. Through the Septuagint, it seems to imply that it's through the generations. But here, it doesn't seem to say by the help of. Yet our English translators seem to move in that direction.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting issue. I happen to have written an article for Vetus Testamentum that was published this year on Genesis 4:1, arguing that kana there means to procreate, but we'll probably have to save that for at least my portion of that to maybe another episode.
Yeah, we'll pick up with them getting kicked out of the garden and stuff in the next time. I still want to take you there. So both of you haven't addressed my sense about signaling that this is mythological, that this shouldn't be a history. This is a meaning-making kind of accounting we're giving here.
What we can state, I think, in terms of proper noun, again, I think really it's Genesis 4 that we're going to start to see Adam, as we would think of him, start to appear. But it's actually Genesis 1:26 Adam will appear without the definite article, without the, in the priestly account. So literally, we're going to read Elohim Vayomer. Then he said, "Let us make Adam. Let us make human, or human. Well, you couldn't even say human. So let us make man, I guess, is the best translation of it. Let us make man in our image, after our likeness." And then there is this switch, and let them, have dominion over the fowl of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth. So there's that archetype that you're looking for, Dan. It is in 26. It is with Adam as humankind. And then 27, so God created man in his, again, Adam, in his own image, in the image of God, we read in the King James Version and almost every other Bible translation I'm familiar with. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And the word God there is once again Elohim, which, as Tom so insightfully explained to us, can be either God singular or gods in the plural. And this is something I get excited about because in my dissertation that analyzes in part this chapter, I made the argument that really Elohim there should be rendered as gods, not only thematically, but grammatically. It should definitely be interpreted in that way. So in other words, I would translate it as, so God created man in his own image, in the image of gods, in the plural, created he him, male and female, implying that from this author's perspective, there are gods in the plural, and there are male deities, and there are female deities. And this was one of the things that my dissertation explored that I get very excited about.
Amen.
Cool. And again, Mormonism would probably kind of pique your interest in this, but clearly you had to argue it through the canons of scholarship.
Historical analysis, and it's been kind of fun because I've received some interesting feedback I would say that I came to this observation independently. And one of the scholars who sat on my dissertation committee was a biblical scholar, former Harvard University professor by the name of Michael Coogan, who wrote this fantastic popular book entitled God and Sex, What the Bible Says, What the Bible Really Says. That's the official title. And it came out, and he makes some similar arguments to those that I was making in my dissertation, including the concept. Coogan goes forward and says, he says, it's a possibility. We could render that verse as gods in the plural, but he said, it's tough to say. Well, I had already come up with some reasons why I felt like it was definitely the most compelling reading to take on that. So indeed, it's from the approach, I'm a believing Latter-day Saint, so despite my attempt and effort to approach the text objectively and critically, I have a background in which I'm sensitive to seeing those sorts of issues, and I try to be critical, but at the same time, I'm going to see the text a certain way. I can't completely divorce myself from my own theological background.
Well, Genesius and Brown Driver and Briggs and some of the others have kind of alluded to that through the years, haven't they? But people don't often follow that up, theologically.
Yes. So I won't go into all of the grammatical reasons why, but in Hebrew, but I think I presented a pretty compelling case to render it as such.
Nice. Go, David, go. Hey, well, let's stick in the first account a little bit more. Let's go back to verse 2. I know that's a very interesting verse. There's a lot of Hebrew verbs that suggest some pretty, I don't know, they feel really profound to me when you kind of explore the verbs. Do you guys, Tom, are you ready to do a quick look at 2 and 1, chapter 1, verse 2? The earth was without form and void, and the darkness was on the face of the deep, all that.
Yeah, they often call this the chaos motif.
Yeah.
And it's been debated by many scholars, did the Babylonian redaction of Genesis write this back into the Hebrew narrative there, or how far back does the water god of chaos, of Yom, in the Canaanite structures, make war and try to thwart God's creation to bring it order, which is, you know, real interesting here. One of the things that I think sometimes the higher critics do not bring out here is when we get to the light and the darkness, as Edward Young points out, and he quotes some very world-renowned scholars as saying that there's two words for light, you know, or and neor. And a lot of times the liberal scholar will not always tell you that. They will just tell you, well, therefore the book of Genesis is non-consistent, you know, that it's non-accurate, that it's a bunch of missy. They couldn't even get the light and the darkness right there. I'd like to hear, David, your thoughts on that.
I don't know that I have a specific thought on the light and darkness issue as much as, how to pick up on that.
My reason for asking this is, well, first of all, Tom, I thought your thing was interesting because people are saying, oh, if it's the water god and all that stuff. To me, that ignores the whole psychological thing. Most people would simply say, you know, there's chaos and it's pre-existing stuff before order is brought to it. It feels more like a psychological thing that you would just assume it, and I wouldn't need to have the water god and you know, who does that sound more like a Babylonian versus, you know, whatever. I'm not even going to dare guess what the other groups were at this time. So, but I like this idea, you know, the earth was without form and void. Darkness was on the face of the deep. I understand that that's sort of chaos, right? That's basically when you say it's the chaos motif. There's this spirit that's brooding over it. And isn't the spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters? Also, I've heard somewhere along the line that that term means it's the same thing you'd use for a hen brooding.
A mother hen, and it's a zoophomorphism for, a motherhood watching over creation.
Yeah, and so I just like that idea that, you know, if we all just think of there's the ordered world, there's the unordered world, and that there would be a preparatory kind of, you know, if there is chaos and I want to bring order into it, I would have to sit with it. I'd have to brood on it. I would have to move up. You know, in other words, I really like that there's a lot going on for this very long period of time that we might be calling the first day.
And as you know, the tohu wabohu, the va consecutive, has been debated. Is there a great gap between the verses by George Timber and others? I don't really see a gap there. I think it's like constructing a temple, as Sorensen, you know, has pointed out, and there's layers to the construction of the argument.
I'll pick up on that, Dan. It's exactly like constructing a temple. In fact, the entire narrative parallels the construction of the tabernacle, again providing evidence that this is a priestly author who sees God dividing darkness from light, like a priest divides holiness from that which is unholy.
Yes.
So it's God in the idea is God is the great cosmic priest doing this great work that is very similar to the tabernacle. And you know, you're exactly right. I love your analysis, Dan, of verse 2. I think it's very profound and from a theological perspective. And it will interest Latter-day Saint listeners without question to note that really, the standard view for verse 2, and for I'd say the consensus scholarly, is to interpret that as an aside, that the actual narrative itself begins with verse 1 and then continues into verse 3. It's one of the reasons I love, the Jewish Publication Society, because they pick up on that and they translate the first verse as a dependent clause. When God began to create heaven and earth, then they provide a hyphen. And verse 2 is identified as an aside, and the hyphen then again picks up and stands right before verse 3. So the actual narrative as follows, again, the consensus in terms of a literary analysis. When God began to create heaven and earth, God said, let there be light. That is the first creative act. Therefore, everything that you've just identified is really an aside, and we have things that are of substance. Picking up on Tom's idea of the chaos motif. Well, we have reference to the earth itself as something that exists prior to the first creative act. It's, of course, without form, and it's void, but it's still earth. It exists prior to creation. And there is water. There is water that is there. There's the...
Oh, so water isn't just a representative of chaos there.
Well, no. What it is, I believe it's happening there, is that water, deep, earth, and even the spirit, the word ruach in Hebrew, the wind, it's a symbol, it's a way of representing unorganized chaos that exists prior to creation. Now, this is important to us as Latter-day Saints, because Joseph Smith is going to step forward and he's going to say, the traditional concept that Christians espouse of creation ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, Joseph says, I reject it. He rejects it. Well, whether Joseph is right or wrong, the fact is that Genesis chapter 1 views creation as a matter of organizing the earth that is without form and without void, all of that material, including the water and the deep, that exist prior to the first creative act, which is in verse 3, when God speaks the words, let there be light. And what's so fascinating in comparing that with Genesis chapter 2 is it's the exact same structure. So Genesis chapter 2, 4b begins with a dependent clause, when the Lord God made earth and heaven. The Jewish Publication Society does the same thing, Ben Dan. They put a hyphen after heaven, and then we have an aside. And it picks up in verse 7. So all of that material in 5 and 6 is an aside, and it's in both accounts, you have the introduction, an aside that talks about pre-creation, and then the actual narrative that picks up later on in the text.
Wow.
And in Genesis chapter 2, then, so the actual account reads, when the Lord God made earth and heaven, the Lord God formed man from the dust of the earth. That's verse 7. So verses 5 and 6, it's pre-creation, just like we had in Genesis 1. When no shrub on the field was yet on earth, and no grasses of the field had yet sprouted, because the Lord God had not sent rain upon the earth, and there was no man to till the soil, but a flow would well up from the ground and water the whole surface of the earth. So in both creation accounts, we have God taking chaos, taking that which is in disorder, and organizing it, giving it structure to create the universe that we know of as human beings. And it does ultimately then reflect Joseph Smith's theological view.
Interesting. And who knows if it's Smith intuiting it, if it's Satius, his teacher, all the different things influencing him. But yeah, this is basically does fit pretty well with that. Now, I wanted to just quickly talk about the firmament. In the next installment of this, I definitely want to go through the flood and this waters above and the waters below and all that will come apart. But let's just acknowledge here, would you guys describe what the heck the cosmology was back at the time this was written, with that you would have this thing called the firmament? Because I think Mormons just don't, they never think about what the people meant back then by a firmament.
Some translations say expanse.
Okay, well, whichever one works for you, but I'm looking for the piece of the earth, you know, because the earth was considered like a flat disk that was floating on a primeval ocean of some sort, right?
Right, and like there was a great vapor and a canopy, if you go with the canopy theory.
So that's not the dominant theory, because isn't that what the firmament is, sort of this oval thing that goes over the earth that stands upon the pillars of heaven? And the stars and the...
That is true. You had the fountains of the deep on one end, and then you had the canopy that, because the heavenly vault had not been opened yet to provide rain and so on and so forth.
Right.
Yeah, most commentators go there.
Yeah, so basically, this is partly why, because this firmament has the stars and everything embedded in it, and that's why there was such trouble in the middle, you know, centuries, the middle teen centuries, when they started to notice changes, because there can't be change in the heavens, because they're fixed into this substantive thing called the firmament.
And some of this field cosmology, you know, is being introduced, you know, here with the moon, the sun, the stars, you know, just like in Genesis 1.
Right. So we shouldn't, I guess what I'm trying to say, and Dave, maybe you can say, have you had success when you teach this? Hey, kids, don't be thinking that they have anywhere close to the same model of earth and heaven and the universe and, you know, comets, you know, coming through from distant solar systems. They completely don't think that. And we do ourselves a huge disservice if we even imagine that they think like us, and that this is some kind of astronomical text or cosmological system that we should worry about.
Precisely, Dan. Exactly. The word in Hebrew is rakia, and it is translated in the King James Version as the firmament. I like Tom's translation, expanse, better. Ultimately, the way I describe it for students, it's a plastic dome, okay? And it's up above us because there are waters above and waters below.
Right.
And the way I try to make students understand this is that if you've ever been out on a beautiful, bright, sunny day when there isn't a cloud in the sky, sit on your back and look up into the sky, and it looks like the ocean. It just looks like the sea. And if there was no gravity, you could almost see yourself falling down into this incredible huge pool of water. Well, this is precisely the way that ancients perceived the universe. They look up there, it's blue, it's ocean, and it makes great sense because every once in a while what comes down?
Rain.
Rain, water.
Through those windows of heaven.
Precisely.
Right.
Exactly, which is what you have in the terms of the flood narrative, which we can get to.
Right.
The flood narrative, God is going to break up the fountains of the great deep, so the water below that has been separated and dried out through the firmament versus the waters up above. He'll open up the window in heaven, which is the term that is used there. And interesting again for Mormons, because in Malachi, what does God say? If you pay your tithing, I'll open up a window in heaven and pour, the verb to pour out, a blessing upon
right.
you.
Loud. Some translations use the term vault, you know, and
yeah.
the ancients also believed that the earth had a navel, you know, on the abyss side of it, way down at the bottom, you know, where life began. So when it says make no images of things beneath the earth, you know, you do not, you know, make idols that even come from the navel of the earth.
There's a point to make there that should be able to go over even in Sunday school, because we see these people with these tortured views of, you know, or, oh, the firmament is, you know, the heavens, and they don't have a sense that they're dealing with an entire, you know, just like we don't have a sense that Joseph Smith's and the Word of Wisdom came before germ theory was even,
sure.
you know, there.
Sure.
We just have to remember that this is completely a different cosmology.
There definitely is a Sunday school point to be made here, and it can be discussed in that sort of environment. And that is, we can use Doctrine and Covenant Section 1, where we read Joseph Smith's revelation, where he states, these revelations, he says, well, commandments, right, but they're revelations, were given unto my servants in their weakness, in accordance with their understanding and their language.
Yep.
And so I like to use that to explain, this is the way they perceive the world, and so it's not a scientific account, it's a way of trying to make sense of the universe and teach what, from a Latter-day Saint perspective, could be identified as inspired theological constructs about God and our relationship to Him. It's their effort to reach out and make sense of the divinity by which they had been touched. And that's what's going on here. And it's done, therefore, going back to we actually will see sea monsters in this account
yeah.
that God is going to create. But there's also something else going on there that works for a Sunday school lesson. And we can get to this later, but what happens is the creation is highly structured. So going back to the firmament, separating the waters from above, the waters below, what happens the first day is God divides the lights. Then on day four, 3 days later, he's going to create those entities that connect with the division of light, the sun, the moon, the stars. On day two, he'll divide the waters from up above, the waters below, with that firmament that we read of in the King James Version. Then, 3 days later, he's going to create, on day five, he's going to create the fish that pertain to the waters below and the birds, because they pertain to the waters above, because they fly up in the sky.
Hmm.
On day three, he's going to create the land. 3 days later, he'll create those things that pertain to the land.
Oh,
and
nice.
That here, the humans and the animals in that creation account. So it's incredibly systematic. It's highly structured. It's well thought out. It's organized. And it provides a theological commentary on God, that he has a plan in mind, that he has a plan, that he's in control, that we can, as human beings, put our faith in this deity who has something there in mind and has worked these things out in every detail, every jot and tittle, if you will, to borrow the King James New Testament phrase.
And it's all tov ma'ov, very good, just as God is good.
Excellent. Yes.
Yeah, creation is not bad. The way we teach it oftentimes in the more evangelical, you know, approaches to original sin and the fall.
Yeah, that is a nice positive way of phrasing that. Well, good. So anything striking you that we've left out of this Genesis 1, which again, is, or the first one, the P document version, anything else that you think we need to do? We've already mentioned the man and woman coming together at the same time. We don't have anything with the rib. We don't have anything with trial and error, like you sort of get with the Genesis, the second one, right?
I loved how Tom brought us into the idea of the chaos concept and the idea of theomachy. There's an important term for our listeners to be aware of. Theomachy refers to divine combat. And in the world of the Bible, this is oftentimes the way we see God creating the universe. Genesis chapter 1 has some sort of relationship. Scholars debate back and forth what that is. But it definitely has some sort of relationship to a text known as Enuma Elish, which is a Babylonian story of cosmic kingship. It explains how their local god, Marduk, becomes the chief god of the universe. And it has a beautiful creation account that really thematically shares so much in common, even structurally, with Genesis 1, to the point that many scholars have argued that Genesis 1 is directly dependent upon it. Well, in that story, Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, creates the universe by going to war. He goes to divine combat with this sea monster, Tiamat. And we see this not only there, but it's this idea of creation through going to war, going to combat, that we see all over the world of the Bible. Now, that stands in direct contrast to what we see in terms of the image of creation in Genesis chapter 1. There really is no theomachy. There's no divine combat whatsoever. And Tom drew our attention to that. It's so different. Now, I would argue that for this documentary source, theomachy will appear. But it's not in the beginning. The divine combat where God, this God of Genesis 1, is going to go to war against the other gods, that's in Exodus. It's pushed into history, and it's going to happen when God goes to war against the gods of Egypt and smites them. And that's Exodus chapter 12, verse 12, where he specifically says, I'm going to go to war against the gods of Egypt, and there's your theomachy. So the priestly author doesn't want that at the beginning. He pushes it into actual history with the creation then of the family of Israel as a free people. But in Genesis chapter 1, it's not there. But we do see references to sea monster in terms of verse 2, the word Hebrew tehom, which is a direct cognate, by the way, meaning equivalent to the Akkadian or Old Babylonian word Tiamat.
And that's my thinking. That's my reference point.
It's the exact same word. It's there, but Tiamat doesn't go to war. So Tom's right. And also we see it in terms of verse 21. Now, our listeners will be familiar with the verse where it's going to say God created. Remember, there's that verb bara, which is a divine verb, very powerful, not used frequently in Genesis chapter 1. But there it's specifically linked with what the King James translates as great whales. And the Hebrew word there does not mean whales at all. In fact, the LDS translation of it is going to give you a footnote that's going to say sea monsters.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it does.
One of my favorite footnotes that is provided in the LDS edition of the Bible, because it's so helpful for what's really happening there. The Hebrew word is tanim. And tanim means sea monsters. It appears later on in the Psalms, Psalm 74, for example, with Leviathan, and there's your theomachy. Their God's going to go to war against the sea monsters. He's going to break their heads and create the world that way. But here it's absent. And some have argued that not only is it absent, but the absent like we would expect it to appear, but it specifically states that God did not fight, but he created the sea monsters in 121. And therefore, perhaps this author is trying to say, yes, there are these other gods out there that you people are familiar with, Marduk and others, who create through theomachy, through divine combat, struggling with the sea monsters to produce the universe. But this God of ancient Israel is so superior to that, he did not fight them, he created them.
Interesting.
That's a beautiful explanation, isn't it?
I like that explanation, and it's a wonderful idea. And again, going back to your idea, Dan, yes, these are academic observations, but Number one, I really believe that Latter-day Saints should understand how scholars interpret these texts, even if they don't accept all the arguments. I think we should be pursuers of truth. We should not be afraid to engage the text critically and understand the way that that scholars have come to an understanding. Once in a while, we'll gain in the process, even if we don't accept the arguments, really profound insights, such as these sorts of ideas that really do work, I would argue, in a Sunday school setting.
So fun. Great.
Well, guys, we're almost through chapter one, or maybe we are through. I'll let you guys tell me what's left in chapter one that we've missed so far.
Well, Genesis 1:26.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, we played a little bit with that, but what are we missing out of that?
It'd be great to hear from Tom theologically on this idea of what he interprets in terms of God's image and how that reflects theologically in his views, without question. That'd be fun.
Well, the key word for me, as Gerhard von Rad has advanced, that the term Selam is more of a similitude.
Selam is the word for image?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's more of a similitude, likeness. Some scholars have said shadow. Some have tried to read the Septuagint to mean, you know, character and other things. I believe, like the LDS do, that it's much stronger, that there are character references attached to it, that there are personality attachments, and it's just a pure likeness to a father, to a son, especially when we look at how the genos or genos theory, you know, plays out, that the ancients believed that man had God's own DNA, to put it in modern terms, and it went through, you know, the veins of a king or a leader, you know, into the subjects that became the Bnei Elohim, the sons of God. And I think we have a real connection with God being literally our Father.
That's very interesting. You know, the traditional Christian interpretation of the idea of man created in the image of God is that man is spiritually in his likeness. And I'll be quite frank, I like that view. I think it's a beautiful theological construct, and it is not foreign to LDS constructs. We do see that, for example, in the questions that Alma asks his people in Alma chapter 5. Have you received his image in your countenance? Referring to this idea that man can, almost like a mirror, reflect back the qualities, the attributes of divinity to God himself. And I like that. So I really like that theological reading. Now, returning to the idea of historical criticism, I'm not convinced that that was the idea that the original author intended. Instead, I'm going to actually go more with what Tom is saying in terms of authorial intent for Selam. That Hebrew word that we translate as image, with in every instance, except for there's one possible exception to this, but in every instance, it means something concrete, something physical. It's used to describe the image or likeness of the gods, for example, in the formation of idols. And reading this historically, reading it contextually, there is another Akkadian connection, meaning the language of ancient Babylon and Assyria. The term Salmu, which is a cognate to Selam in Hebrew, is used in Akkadian accounts to refer to kings. Kings have the image, the Selam, the Salmu in Akkadian, of the gods. And so if I'm reading this text like an ancient Near Eastern person, I come across this statement of God creating, again, what you were talking about, Dan, Adam, as in mankind, humankind.
Okay.
If I read that, it seems to imply that there's some sort of royalty image or motif going on here, that humans are created to be royal, to be kingly and queenly, because, of course, it's gender inclusive. And that's certainly reflected as well in the concept that is we read in the King James. They are created in the image. They are to rule. They are to have dominion. They are to be kings and queens, in a sense. So that's a very fascinating view, this Selam, and I'm glad Tom addressed that.
Yeah, von Rad addresses it in his comment on Demut and Kamare Adam, and he compares it to Genesis 1:26 on page 59, and he says it is God taking on like a human form in that particular verse, and I think the Akkadian strengthens a position that we're very much like God.
You know, it reminds me then, Tom and Dan, that of a fantastic statement that I once heard Zeoni Zebit, a very famous biblical scholar, state in the context of a lecture that he gave at Boston University on biblical violence. And he was reading this wonderful paper, and in the middle of the reading, he broke form, and I don't even remember the context, but he said, you know, just and off the cuff, you know, it's not so much that ancient Israelites viewed God as anthropomorphic as much as they viewed humans as theomorphic.
Right.
And
spot on.
Yeah, and I just thought, wow, that was a really brilliant piece of commentary. Not so much that they viewed God as human-like, as much as humans are divine, they're kingly, they're in the image, the selim of God. And it's not only here in this priestly text, but it certainly happens in the second creation story. It might also be of interest then to kind of hit on this idea of the plurality reference, the let us make man in our image.
Please do.
Of course, the traditional way that most Jews and Christians have interpreted that reference to plurality is a plurality of majesty, that God is speaking to himself, and that's because historically most Christians and Jews have been radical monotheists. That's not the way that contemporary scholars would read the text. The general academic consensus is this is an allusion to God speaking in first-person plural references to the divine council of gods. It's not only a view that we see theologically running all throughout the Hebrew Bible, but again, going back to historical criticism, when an ancient Near Eastern person encountered a text such as this, the concept of God speaking in a plural was very well known, and it, especially in the context of creation. One of the texts that I do like to point my students to is a Sumerian Babylonian creation tradition from 800 BCE that is entitled Kar 4. It's the name of it, but I'll share a little bit of it because it's so interesting in light of what we see in Genesis chapter 1. So the text starts off this way: O Ananu gods, great gods, what should we do next? What should we make now? The great gods who were present and the Ananu gods, ordainers of destinies, both replied to Enlil. Enlil's this god of the wind. In Uzumu, the linking place of heaven with earth, let us slaughter Allah gods. And then here's this line: let us create humankind from their blood. Notice the plurality reference here to the divine council. The divine council, let us create humankind, reflecting this idea of let us make man in our image. This is one text, and it goes on, and then humankind is created to, in the text, to set the pickaxe and work basket in their hands, to make the great dwelling of the gods, to build a sanctuary, to work the ditches. And that's this motif of humankind created to be the agricultural servants of the gods that we find all throughout Mesopotamian sources, and is picked up as a motif in Genesis chapter 2.
Right.
So there are all these references. This is one. We could go to the ancient tablets of Ugarit, modern-day Rashamra in Syria, where there's, of course, a lot going on politically right now. 1929, some Canaanite, if I can refer to them as such, tablets were discovered that shed a lot of cultural, religious, and linguistic insights into the Hebrew Bible. And we're going to see text where, again, you know, in reference to king, we're going to see a text such as, so answers King El. El, again, the god, the head god of the pantheon, the compassionate. Sit, sons, on your seats, on the thrones of your princeships. I myself shall act the craftsman, and I shall create. I shall create a remover of sickness, an expeller of disease. And he goes on. So here is the head god of the pantheon speaking to the other gods of the assembly, say, in the context of creation, telling them, I'm going to create, I'm going to do this. And I've just given two of many texts that we could cite that have been covered from the world of the Bible, that if we apply historical criticism, leads to the observation that in Genesis 1, 26, 27, God speaks to other divinities, says, let us create man in our image after our likeness. And then that ties in very well with, of course, my reading that I offered a few minutes ago in terms of this concept that God, that humankind, male and female, are created in the image of Elohim, the image of gods. So it's a fun piece of information.
Wow.
Yeah, Klaus Westermann develops a lot of these texts along with what David is saying in his commentary, Genesis 1 through 11, where many of those texts are cited. And if any of our listeners wonder, how can they read something that will compare those Mesopotamian sources with the Hebrew Bible, Westermann is certainly one of them, isn't he?
Yes. Wonderful commentary series, without question. The three-volume set published through Continental Press. So that's a definite keeper in terms of academic studies.
Let me ask something here. So, David, did I hear you right that you said this would be the scholarly consensus for this now?
Yes.
Right? So, yeah. So what percentage of people are, because they're so married to monotheism in every instance within the Bible, are like working really hard, and you can just sort of see them like the Dutch boy, or, just putting out fire is the best they can do. They're just kicking against the evidence.
Tom would be better probably to address that. It's not, I really haven't seen a lot of people try to argue in recent years against that sort of view. It's just...
And so then why aren't the Mormons, trumpeting this everywhere? So it's like, is it again because we don't have the people at BYU and places like that that have the ability to say, hey, gang, take us more seriously?
Oh, boy. That's a good question, Dan.
Okay.
I do have an insight from the theological side of the paradigm.
Go for it.
Number one, many churches have seen what I was speaking about, what happened to the mainline churches. And that is a road they don't want to go down.
Okay.
According to Kermode and Robert Alters, who are more literary experts, more than they are Bible scholars, they say that 85% of scholarship believes in JEPD. And so the rest of the 15%, would be your textual critics who believe there's purity in the text. And therefore, there are absolute readings that one must adhere to. The rest of it is on a theological preface that many of the inerrantists still uphold, like Geisler and Nix, and many of the people such as John Warwick Montgomery on the Lutheran front. They are fighting like crazy within the Lutheran camps to keep inerrancy alive and respectable.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess I can, now that I think this through and listen to Tom, I can maybe add a little bit of an insight into that, and I want to tread carefully because I don't want to be offensive to anyone. What we have historically seen happening in terms of conservative seminaries, conservative theological seminaries, and their students that they send to graduate work, quite frequently these students will go into a peripheral topic instead of biblical scholarship directly. And Tom hinted towards that in terms of literary analysis. And they're oftentimes encouraged to do this because if a student studies the Bible academically and critically, the student has to bump up against source criticism, which makes a lot of conservative readers very uncomfortable. So what we do see in terms of serious scholars who work with the Bible that reject the consensus on some of these views, and they are out there, oftentimes you'll see that their actual academic training was in a history of biblical interpretation rather than the Bible itself.
Mm.
Or they'll do comparative Semitics, or they'll do, Assyriology or Egyptology, something along that lines. And then they return to their respective faith communities and, are used as experts in the Bible. And so that's something that conservative seminaries, and that's been the trend to some extent, we as Latter-day Saints we've followed along, and I'll just say it as it is. In fact, I was actually, I was encouraged by a BYU professor once I made the decision to go to Brandeis to not study the Bible itself, Instead, do Ugaritic, special in Northwest Semitics, do something else. And in fact, was told is that, you know, if you go into Bible, there's a very good chance that you will lose your testimony, your faith. I ignored that advice, obviously, but I'm not trying to be disrespectful, because the truth is that it is challenging. It's challenging. Once a person starts to delve into the text itself, it challenges our assumptions. It breaks down traditional paradigms. And if a person still wants to believe, then that can be a challenge. But I don't believe it's an either or, especially for Mormonism. We ought to be able to. Well, I agree in terms of my approach to Mormonism. I love the Prophet Joseph Smith's perspective. He said, you know, Mormonism is a philosophy that seeks to embrace all truth, let it come from whatever source it may. And my view is if we hold, as Latter-day Saints, an incorrect paradigm in terms of scriptural origins and how these texts develop, then darn it, Mormonism is a philosophy that should seek to break down that paradigm. That's certainly the way that Joseph Smith approached his faith.
Yeah. And so what you just said there, there's two parts of my response for that. Number one is it will challenge things, but here in this case, at least, this is like, hey, woohoo, Joseph Smith got something that seems to be more original to the text. So that's the one part. And
sure.
But the other part of that saying the thing is, did you think he got that? How long was he teaching this before he started getting his, you know, the School of the Prophets, and they brought in Josiah Satius and these, you know, before he began to really, you know, work with historical criticism as it stood at that day?
Yeah, it's difficult to put an exact date on that, but you've already, in a sense, answered your question as far as I can answer it, and that is definitely by the time he begins to study Hebrew, learns about the fact that Elohim is plural, that begins to affect his interpretations theologically. That is used to help him to help produce the Book of Abraham, that perspective.
And That's a good connection.
And that theology that he has on the plurality of gods, without doubt, line upon line, precept upon precept, continues to evolve until we eventually get those incredible sermons in Nauvoo, where he's going to play with Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and tell us that that's the way it currently reads, is not the way the original author wrote it. It was, you know, he says a prepositional bait was added to it. That wasn't there. Instead, it's a reference to the head god calling together the gods in council to organize the earth. So, yeah, it's fascinating to see the ways in which we now, as scholars, understand the text that reflect Joseph Smith's perspective. Quite frequently, they're spot on, and certainly there are others that challenge us as Latter-day Saints. And I think we should be willing to address both angles.
Okay, Tom, anything more on this?
The communities of faith across the board have to keep up with what scholars are saying. And I think in the LDS position, as they try to reach out and have social justice with liberal and evangelical Christians, some of the leaders may feel, and I'm guessing here just a little bit, oh, we just don't need, you know, more flies in the ointment, you know. And in some of our churches, take the Seventh-day Adventist Church, 67% of the members are fundamentalists. And so when you have that kind of conservative, you know, membership, you know, politically and economically and every other way, their worldview, they can be quite hard on scholars. And I know this because, you know, I run a PhD program that teaches Bible in four languages and the broad Eastern theological landscape. And there seems to be another problem, not only the conservative denominational community of faith issue. Foursquare would fit that, Assemblies of God, you know, many Baptist sectors would fit that. And who funds the seminaries? So you've got a political landscape there going on, like happened at Baylor University many years ago, where if you wouldn't swear to inerrancy, you were fired. And some wonderful men were let go who had marvelous specialties. And so there is this theological thing right now going on in the churches. Let's just hold back. Let's not rock the boat. even with the conservatives who took over the former progressive liberal commentary, called interpreters, Wayne House and the Fundamentalists have now issued the new edition of that that's come out in the last 4 years of interpreters. It's no longer progressive. It's extremely evangelical now, like the ISBE was, the International Bible Encyclopedia. Why? Because the evangelicals had the money. And let me tell you, they're dancing in the streets because in their mind, they've reversed JEPD.
Wow.
So there's some of the landscape out there, and the chasm is not getting more friendly from one side to another. Professional associations now exist and have existed since the 1980s with these scholars to promote nothing but inerrancy.
Quite the battle. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.